are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 19th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist, best-selling author, Johan Hari will be joining us to discuss lost connections, uncovering the real causes of depression, and the unexpected solutions. Also on the program today, United States is detaining immigrant children now at clandestine shelters. New York Times reports Deutsche Bank found Donald Trump lied about being a billionaire. Facebook, meanwhile, bemoans the lack of local news for it to exploit after having destroyed it.
To help with connectivity.
Meanwhile, Nebraska sustaining massive flooding. Dozens of counties underwater have declared emergency across the state. Meanwhile, high school students in New York City, or I should say high schools in New York City, have an elite public school integration problem. And Devin Nunes is suing Twitter for $250 million because he gets no retweets. Joe Biden pretending to weigh an early running mate pick. Missouri Republican counties reject Roy Blunt for voting against Donald Trump's emergency wall measures. And lastly, Scott Walker still lives, now professionally pushing for a constitutional convention for a balanced budget amendment, bankrolled, of course, by the Koch brothers. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday. Particularly sensitive to the story about the high school students who got into the in New York City. It really is a bit of a nightmare for kids getting into high school. And I speak from direct experience, one which ended yesterday right after the show. But there are a half a dozen elite schools in the city that are citywide you can get into. Many schools are citywide, but these are specifically you need to test into. And the testing is pretty rigorous. And many, many kids get tutored or to test. Specifically, you know, for these tests, of course, that costs money. I am aware of this. My child was one of those children who did so. She did not get into those schools. But in New York City, there were something like 1,000 kids who were admitted into some of these top schools. And only 7 were African-American. And there's been an attempt and we're talking, there's actually like another level of elite schools beyond that other level. And it's highly problematic and they're still trying to figure out what exactly to do about it because, you need some measure, I guess, but let's play this AOC clip. I want to do this. I will say, though, that here is AOC at a meeting expressing the issue here. Now, many high school students it's rare to have a high school student who goes to a school that is, you know, just a 5-minute walk away from them in New York City. More often than not, the commute's anywhere from 10 to 15 to 20 minutes to can be an hour and a half, hour 20 minutes, depending on where they wanted to go. And my daughter applied to 12 schools plus the taking the specialized test and some that you have to audition for. So there's a wide range of schools, but there's also a wide divergence in the quality of schools. Far wider divergence than there should be. And this, of course, is dictated in many respects by geography, by the wealth of the people who live in any given neighborhood in New York City. And people who have lived in New York City for any period of time can see this development or who are sensitive to it because they have kids or they know people with kids. As neighborhoods gentrify, the schools end up lagging in terms of achievement 10, 12, 15 years or so. And in part, it's simply because more people move into the neighborhood who have money. Because of that money, they have the ability to either give money to the school, literally give it to the school. And the divergence I've seen between parent-teacher advisory board, parent-teacher associations' budgets range anywhere from $25,000 annually, some $15,000 annually, to $1 million a year. That's a big difference. You have the ability to almost like add 25% or 20% to your school's budget annually. That makes a big difference in the quality of education the kids are going to get because suddenly they're going to have second teachers in the classrooms, assistant teachers. They're going to have after-school programs that are enrichment. They're going to have programs during the school, art, other programs. Not to mention all the research we know about kids showing up at school with far better remedial skills from wealthier families. Just because they get more direct time with adults, they get more experiences as a child to develop their vocabulary and their, you know, just brains are rather elastic at that age. So all of this is a function of some of the issues of the schooling here. AOC met with a group of parents. And it's interesting, the cross currents of fights in New York City about schools is the currents go in about 15 different directions. But at one point, she, towards the end of this talk, sort of provides a much starker sense of where the line should be drawn in these sort of debates.
Because it's important that we have this discussion. My father was an exception to this rule, an exception to these statistics. So my dad was born in the South Bronx while the Bronx was burning. He was raised 5 people in a 1-bedroom apartment. And he did what he had to do, and my dad got into Brooklyn Tech. So my dad grew up. And growing up, my dad always told me about this experience going to Brooklyn Tech. He told me about what his life was like, where as a teenager, he got up and left his apartment at 5 o'clock in the morning every day to get onto the 6 train or to get onto the 4 train and ride a very dangerous subway during the 70s at 15 years old to go to Brooklyn Tech because it was seen as his only opportunity to have a dignified life. And he loved his experience at Brooklyn Tech because he went to a good school. My question is, why are there only 5 or a handful of schools in New York City that are seen to get a degree? My question is, why isn't every public school in New York City we need to put our children first. And so I understand the concern. But my concern, I'd be happy to engage with these folks. My concern is that this right here, when we're fighting each other, is exactly what happens under a scarcity mindset. Because this should not be the fight. This should be the fight. This should not be the fight. We are in this.
So she's, I mean, and some of this is visual, but she's making the argument that the problem here is you have such intense fighting over these resources because the resources are limited, because you don't have great schools all across the city or open to every student. Now, the reality is when it comes to education, the inputs are far outweigh anything else that can happen in the school in terms of what the outcomes are. So in other words, schools cannot fix societal ills. They reflect them. And despite that, New York has figured out how to at least make some schools top-performing schools. Not like Brooklyn Tech, I mean, has been in a traditionally, a wealthy neighborhood. I mean, now everywhere in Brooklyn is getting moneyed in some way. But Fort Greene was not exactly a posh neighborhood, certainly not in the 70s. But the idea of being able to, put resources in there and get the top performing students around the city and put them all in one place, there is, at the very least, some type of roadmap to improve the quality of schools. And a lot of that has to do with financing. And so there is a huge opportunity there, that a roadmap in the future. We weren't going to start with this. I'm sensitive to it because, obviously, my daughter just found out what school she's going to yesterday. And she's deciding between two schools. So we'll see.
Mazel tov.
Yes. LaGuardia or Morrow. She got in for the vocal programs in both. Yes, I think longtime listeners are aware of her pipes, as it were. But and I will take from any type of admissions folk, if you're involved in any way in education in New York City or colleges that are aware of these schools, I will take your advice. Send me an email. Tell me, because we have no idea. She may have to commute like an hour to go to LaGuardia, a little bit less for Morrow. All right, we should take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Johan Hari about lost connections, uncovering the real causes of depression and the unexpected solutions. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program journalist, best New York Times bestselling author of his last book, Chasing the Scream. Now for his latest, which is out in paperback, I think, in just a couple of months, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Johan Hari, welcome back to the show.
Oh, hey, Sam. I'm so happy to be back with you.
So, all right, let's, let's just start with that as a follow-up to Chasing the Scream, which you wrote in terms of addiction. Basically, the argument, and I want to paint with too broad a brush, but the argument in Chasing the Scream was that connection is more or less the opposite of addiction. What brought you to Lost Connections?
Yeah, it's a good question. There were these two mysteries that were really hanging over me. And if I'm honest, I was quite afraid to look into them. And they were very connected in some ways. I use that word not ironically, with some of the things that I've been writing about in Chasing the Scream. So the first mystery is I'm 40 years old, and every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased here in the United States and across the Western world. And I wanted to understand why. Why are so many people finding it so much harder to get through the day? And why is it going up year after year, to the point where now last week the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, you know, announced we now have the highest level of suicide in American history. And that doesn't include opioid-related overdoses, which are also at epidemic levels. So what's going on here? One of the reasons I was frightened to look into this is because of the second mystery, which is when I was a teenager, I remember going to my doctor and explaining that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me. I couldn't control it. I couldn't regulate it. I didn't understand what was going on, and I felt quite ashamed of it. And my doctor told me a story that I now realize wasn't totally wrong, but was really oversimplified. My doctor said, we know why people get depressed like this. It's because there's a problem in their brain. Some people have a natural chemical imbalance. Some people are just lacking a chemical called serotonin that makes people feel good. All we need to do is give you this drug, you're going to be fine. So I started taking an antidepressant called Paxil, and I did get a really significant boost from it. A few months later, this feeling of pain came back. So I went back to my doctor. He said, clearly, I don't give you a high enough dose. I was given a higher dose. Again, I felt a boost. Again, this feeling of pain came back. And I was in this cycle of jacking up the dose more and more until for 13 years, I was taking the maximum possible dose, at the end of which I was still depressed. And I seemed to be surrounded by more and more people who were becoming depressed. And I kind of, part of me thought, if it was just a problem in our brains, why would it be rising so much? But at the same time, you know, when you've got a story about your pain, even if it's not working very well for you, and that story was not working very well for me, at least you feel like you know where you are. I was really reluctant. There was this moment when I felt like if I explore these different ways of thinking, it's almost like letting the pain off the leash, right? If the pain is like a wild animal, if you let it off the leash, you don't know where you are. You don't know how it will attack you. But I kind of steeled myself to go on this journey. So I ended up going on a really big journey. I wanted to use my training in the social sciences to go and meet the leading scientists in the world who've written about depression and anxiety and how to solve them. And I wanted to sit with people who have really, really different perspectives as well, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have very low levels of depression, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would make people feel better, to a lab in Baltimore where they were giving people psychedelics to see if that would help. And I learned a huge number of things, a lot of which I think connect with the themes that you report on in the Majority Report a huge amount of the time. I learned that there's scientific evidence for 9 causes of depression and anxiety. 2 of them are indeed in our biology. Your genes can make you more sensitive to this. And there are real brain changes that happen when you become depressed that can make it harder to get out. But most of those 9 factors that are causing depression and anxiety that I write about in Lost Connections are not in our biology. They are factors in the way we live. They're things that you cover all the time, Sam. And once you understand those factors, it opens up a new set of solutions that should be offered as part of an expanded menu alongside the option of chemical antidepressants.
You know, it's, I mean, it's total coincidence, but just a couple of days ago, maybe was it I can't remember if it was last week. I have no recollection of time. We had Rutger Bregman on, who
my friend. I love him. Yeah.
Well, you know, his book Utopia for Realists. There's some prescriptions that you talk about in your book. That he talks about in Utopia for Realists, and the notion of a concept of general happiness, and there are overlaps here, and I have a feeling we'll bump into those. But just as you know, as you mentioned, like, you know, things that you talk about on this program, we literally were touching on sort of the, I guess, a more sort of like policy oriented, but in many respects, many of the things that you're talking about are arguably a function of our the capitalist system and the failures in some instances of the capitalist system to, you know, maybe not necessarily inherent in capitalism, or I should say, necessary to have along with capitalism, but maybe come. But let's get to some of those. And I don't know, I don't want to go through each one of the causes, but let's start, since we were talking about that disconnection from meaningful work. I mean, Bregman cited Graeber's work on bullshit jobs, but let's talk about what you found in terms of this idea, and this is all premised on the idea that we may have within us a predisposition to depression, but that theoretically should not have changed over time in terms of the amount of people. But there could be environmental factors that promote this innate potential to, sadly, to flourish in this instance.
Yeah. Some people, everyone knows, some people find it easier to put on weight and some people find it harder to put on weight. But everyone across American society has put on more weight over the last 40 years, right?
Right.
A similar thing has happened with depression. Some people will find it easier to become depressed than others, but because of changes in the society, it's massively exploded. So work is a great example. I noticed that lots of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. So I started to think, you know, well, what's the evidence for this? Maybe the people I know are unusual. I looked at the best research on this. So Gallup, the opinion poll company, did a massive study of how do people feel about their work. It turned out 13% of us, 1 of 3%, like our work most of the time. 63% are what they called sleep working. You don't like it, you don't hate it, you just kind of get through the day. And 24% of people hate and fear their jobs. I was quite struck by that. That means most of us, in fact, 87% of us, don't like the thing we're doing most of the time. And this thing that we don't like doing is spreading over more and more of the day. The average person now answers their first work email at 7:43 a.m. and leaves work at 7:15 p.m. I started to ask, could this be having some effect on our mental health? I learned that there was an amazing man who I then went to interview, an Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot, who made a really important breakthrough on this in the 1970s. Professor Marmot discovered the key factor, it's not the only one, but the key factor that causes depression at work. If you go to work tomorrow and you have low or no control over your work, you are much more likely to become depressed and anxious. I think this is related to something that goes deeper than work, although it's a key part of this. Everyone listening to Majority Report knows that they have natural physical needs. Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air, over time you need sex. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. But there's equally strong evidence that all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel we've got a future that makes sense. And this culture we built is good at lots of things. I had to go to the dentist the other day. I'm glad to be alive in 2019. But we have been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs. So think about being controlled at work. If you are controlled all the time, if you're like a robot on a line, you can't construct meaning out of your work. But as human beings, we need to feel that what we're doing with our hours and our days are meaningful, that we're not just drones, that we're not just controlled by somebody else. So at first, I actually misunderstood what Professor Marmot was saying, right? So I thought the implication of all this evidence was, okay, you've got this elite 13% at the top who get to have nice jobs they control, and then everyone else is condemned to this misery. And I thought about my family, right? My grandmother's job was to clean toilets. My dad was a bus driver. My brother is an Uber driver. I thought, wait, are we just saying all these people are condemned to this misery? And Professor Marmot explained to me, it's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work. And there's a solution for that. So I went to Baltimore to meet a woman called Meredith Keough. And Meredith used to go to bed every Sunday night just sick with anxiety. She worked in an office, as Meredith would tell you, it wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being bullied or harassed or anything, but it was really monotonous. And Meredith couldn't bear the thought this was going to be the next 40 years of her life until she retired. So one day with her husband, Josh, she did this quite bold thing. When people hear this, they're going to think I'm saying you should do this too. They're going to think I can't do this. And they're right. This is an argument for a structural change. So Josh had worked in bike stores in Baltimore since he was a teenager. And, you know, that's insecure, controlled work. You have no rights or very few rights. One day, Josh was sitting there in the bike store with his friends. They're fixing their bikes. And one of them just said, what does our boss actually do? They didn't hate their boss. He wasn't a particularly bad boss, but they were like, we seem to fix all the bikes and this other dude seems to make all the money. That's such a good deal for us. Josh and his friends decided they were going to sit, and Meredith decided they were going to set up a bike store of their own that worked on a different principle. So the previous place they worked was a corporation. This is a very recent human invention, right? Everyone listening knows how a corporation works. You've got the boss at the top, who's the dictator. You eat, and sometimes they're a nice dictator and sometimes they're Kim Jong-un, but you've got no oversight over that. Sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't. But if you don't obey the dictator, ultimately you're out of the organization, right? They decided they were going to set up a bike store that worked on an older American idea. The store they set up, Baltimore Bicycle Works, is a democratic cooperative, right? It's not a corporation. They don't have a boss. They take the decisions about the business together by voting once every couple of weeks. They share out the profit. They share out the good tasks and the shitty tasks, so no one gets stuck with the shitty tasks. If anyone wants to change the business, they can try and persuade their colleagues to do it. So no one is like a drone. You've got agency. And one of the things that was so striking to me, spending time in Baltimore Bicycle Works, was how many people there talked about how they had been depressed and anxious before, but were not depressed and anxious now, which is totally in line with Professor Marmot's findings, right? It's not like they quit their jobs fixing bikes and went off to become like Beyonce's backing singers, right? They fixed bikes before, they fixed bikes now. What's the difference? Now they have control over their work. How many people do you know who are, you know, who are depressed and anxious at the moment, who would feel really differently if they had work that they controlled with their colleagues, where they had a say, where no one got stuck with the shitty tasks all the time? That's a very different way of spending our time. Now, that's a big structural change. There are lots of smaller things I talk about in Lost Connections that would deal with depression. But I would argue that move from a society dominated by corporations to every business being a democratic cooperative, and by the way, it's even more economically efficient. A study at Cornell University found that democratic businesses grow on average four times faster. That move, that shift, giving people back control over their work, that is an antidepressant. Anything that reduces depression should be regarded as an antidepressant. For some people, that will include chemicals, but precisely because the causes of depression are much deeper. So control and humiliation at work are a big factor. It's one of the nine causes that I talk about. You can see, because the problem is deeper than our biology, the solutions have to be wider than just looking at our biology.
Yeah. And that's, so let me just ask you, in terms of like that notion of we are less good at meeting our psychological needs, right? That,
yeah.
Is that a function that we are less good at it now, or is it that the distance between our psychological needs and how society is structured, the gulf has widened?
The right. Society has changed. I'll give you a specific example, because okay. It can sound a bit weird to people in the abstract. This is the loneliest society in human history. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was five. Today, the most common answer, not the average, but the most common answer is none. There are more Americans who have nobody to turn to when things go wrong than any other option. Half of all Americans asked how many people know you well say nobody. And I spent a lot of time interviewing an amazing man, Professor John Cacioppo, in Chicago, who's the leading expert in the world on loneliness. And he said to me, why are we alive? Why do we exist? Right? Everyone listening to this show, why are you alive? One of the key reasons is that our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't faster than the animals they took down. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down. But they were much better at banding together into groups and cooperating. Just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. And we are the first humans ever to disband our tribes. I would argue that's partly because, not entirely, there's lots of things going on, but because of this neoliberal, ultra-capitalist story we've been told, that you are a selfish economic maximizer. That is what human beings are. That's how you should treat yourself. That's how you should treat other people. We have structured the entire economy and society on that principle. And it's like putting a foot into a shoe that doesn't fit. That's not our nature. That's not who we are, right? And so one of the things I wanted to think about is, again, that can seem like such a big overpowering thing. What is the solution? And one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is an amazing doctor who found one of the solutions to this. So his name is Sam Everington. He's from a poor part of East London, where I'm from, as you can tell from my weird Downton Abbey accent. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with terrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they have some role to play. But he could see two things. Firstly, they were depressed and anxious for perfectly understandable reasons. Their pain made sense, like they were really lonely. And secondly, most of the people he gave chemical antidepressants to got some relief, but ultimately became depressed again. So one day, Sam had an idea. A woman came to see him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know later. Lisa had been shut away in her home with crippling depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs, but I'm also going to prescribe something else. There was an area behind the suite of doctor's offices that was known as Dogshit Alley. It was just like scrubland, basically. Sam said to Lisa, what I'd like you to do is come and turn out a couple of times a week at Dogshit Alley. I'm going to come too because I've been quite anxious. We're going to meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, and we're going to find something to do together. The first time the group met, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But the group starts talking. They're like, what can we do together? They decided, these are inner city East London people like me. They didn't know anything about gardening. They're like, okay, we'll teach ourselves gardening. They start to watch YouTube clips. They start to read books. They start to get their fingers in the soil. They start to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But even more importantly, they start to form a tribe. They start to form a group. They start to care about each other. They start to do what human beings do when we care about each other. They start to solve each other's problems. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. I think for an obvious reason, this is something I saw all over the world, from Sydney to Sao Paulo to San Francisco. The most effective strategies for dealing with depression and anxiety are the ones that deal with the underlying reasons why we feel this way in the first place.
Do you think that the it's interesting because the alienating parts of our society. I mean, two things occur to me. One is the statistics I've seen is that we also are turning out something to the effect of like in 1950 people were asked the question, do you feel special? And only about 10% of the people said that they felt special. And now younger people today, 80% of them think that they're special. But that specialness is also in some respects, pushing the idea of the individual above that of the collective on some level. I mean, how much of that, like, where is that line, right, where this idea of like you're not quite as that a society that teaches you that you're particularly unique also is teaching you simultaneously that you're particularly isolated in some way.
I think this relates to one of the hardest causes of depression. There were two causes of depression and anxiety that were really hard for me to learn about. One was childhood trauma. We can talk about that later if you want. Yeah. But because that had played out a lot in my life. But the other was this one. And, you know, everyone listening to your show knows junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? As someone who basically lived on KFC in my 20s, I don't say that with any sense of superiority. But what's fascinating is something very similar has happened with our minds. A kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. And this is very related to the kind of neoliberal capitalism that you were talking about. So for thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel like shit, right? That's not an exact quote from Confucius, but that is the gist of what he said, right? But nobody had scientifically investigated this until an incredible man I got to know called Professor Tim Kasser at Knox College in Illinois, who's been investigating this for the last 25 years. And he showed a few really important things. One is the more you think life is driven, I'd explain it slightly differently. Imagine you play the piano, right? If you play the piano in the morning because you love it and it gives you joy, that's what's called an intrinsic reason for playing the piano. You're not doing it to get anything out of it. You're doing it because that is the experience you love. Okay, now imagine you play the piano, not because you love it, but because your parents are massively pressuring you to be a piano maestro because that's their dream for you. Or you play the piano in a dive bar that you hate to make the rent. Or you play it to post the clips on Instagram to impress a woman, right? Those would be extrinsic reasons to play the piano. You're not doing it because that gives you a sense of joy. You're doing it to get something out of it further down the line. Now, we're all a mixture of these two kinds of motive, right? You have to be to survive. But Professor Kasser showed some really interesting things. Firstly, the more you are driven by these extrinsic values, what I came to think of as the equivalent of junk food, kind of junk values, the more you're driven by money and status and how you look to other people, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious by a really quite significant amount. I think it relates to this question about needs. That is not a way of living that meets your deeper needs. He also showed, as a society, as a culture, we have become much more driven by these junk values. And in some ways, at first when I learned this, I'm like, yeah, but this is almost like banal, right? Everyone listening to your show knows they're not going to lie on their deathbed and think about all the likes they got on Instagram and all the shoes they bought. They're going to think about moments of love and meaning and connection. But as Professor Kasser put it to me, we live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is important about life. More 18-month-old children in the United States know what the McDonald's M means than know their own last name. From the moment you're born, you are immersed in a machinery that tells you, you know, what is life about? If you don't feel good, go shopping, buy, display it to other people so they'll go shopping and they'll feel better. We create an entire story about happiness that doesn't work. This is a very deliberately created story about happiness. You read the advertising literature. They literally call them manufactured wants. And the reason I say this was hard for me to learn is because, you know, when I used to get depressed, when I'd feel these painful feelings come, very often my recourse was a kind of junk values solution, right? I would earn more. I would buy shit I didn't need. I would show off. I would have some kind of achievement, or I would do someone else down. And I realize now when I think about that, I can't find this clip, but years ago, I remember seeing a clip of a silent movie star. I think it was Buster Keaton, where he's sinking in quicksand. His legs are sinking in quicksand. So to get out, he reaches in with his arms to pull out his legs, which of course means he sinks faster. So then he reaches in with his head to pull out his arms, and then he's completely gone. And I realized that's kind of what I would do, right? I was seeking happiness in the wrong places, in the way that our society tells us to. It made me feel awful. It's not the only thing that was going on, but it was one of the things that made me feel awful. And instead of trying to break with that logic, I would double down on that logic. And I was sunk, right?
I mean, that is the right. That is the sort of the classic neoliberal, function is you rely on the marketplace. It creates a problem, and then you rely on the marketplace to solve the problem that was created by the market in the first place. And so on.
That's such a good way of putting it.
When you talked about tribalism too, I wonder if the breakdown that you talk about, or that sort of that sense that, you know, I don't have five people I could go to like we did in a time before, I have no one to turn to, and we have a physiological need, I guess you could say it, to be part of a tribe. I mean, I can't help but think that, you know, we're living in a very strange era where tribalism plays out around sort of some signifiers that they don't necessarily have any direct meaning. I mean, I think one of the things that's been fascinating about this period of our politics anyways, in terms of what I've seen on the right and left to a certain extent, but more so on the right, but maybe that's just where I'm situated to be able to see it, is that some of these signifiers completely irrelevant. Well, you know, the most closely held belief 16 months later can be completely jettisoned. But the idea is you got to maintain the tribe. And I wonder if, like, the loss of that tribe in a sort of smaller, more impactful on our actual lives way has led to a compulsion for, you know, sort of joining other groups in other ways.
I think you're totally right. I think all the time about this woman that I met in Cleveland in the run-up to the 2016 election. I was with the LA LGBT Center, a wonderful person called Dave Fleischer, and we were trying to get out the vote. And there was this street we were on, a third of the houses were abandoned, a third were demolished, and a third still had people living in them. And we knock on this door, and there's a woman who answered, I would have guessed from looking at her, was 60. I discovered from talking to her, she was the same age as me. I was 37 at the time. And we're chatting, and she was quite articulate. She was extremely angry. She wasn't going to vote for Hillary. And she made this verbal mistake that's really stayed with me. She was talking about what the area used to be like for her parents and grandparents. And she talks about how they left school when they were 16. They got good jobs. And she meant to say, when I was young. What she actually said is, when I was alive.
Right.
And it really knocked me back, right? And it's like that's how a lot of people have been made to feel in this culture. It's one of the reasons why you've got the rise of people like this woman just saying, well, just burn the house down, right? Now, don't get me wrong, I'm desperately trying to stop people voting for Donald Trump, and that woman's problems will be made significantly worse by the rise of by President Trump and his policies. But I do think we have to understand where this is coming from. You know, I think there was one person who really helped me to think differently about this. Two people, actually. So I went to interview this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield, who happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when they first introduced chemical antidepressants in that country. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, had never heard of these drugs, right? So they were like, what are they? And he explained. And the Cambodians said to him, oh, we don't need them. We've already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy like St. John's wort or ginkgo biloba or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who one day stood on the he worked in the rice fields. And one day he stood on a landmine left over from the American invasion of Southeast Asia, and he got his leg blown off. So they gave him an artificial leg, and he goes back to work in the rice fields a few months later. But the guy, apparently it's incredibly painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial leg. I'm guessing it was pretty traumatic for obvious reasons. He's in the field where he got blown up. He starts to cry all day. After a while, he refuses to get out of bed. He's developed classic depression. The Cambodian doctor said, well, that's when we gave him an antidepressant. And Dr. Summerfield said, what? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was screwing him up so much. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. They said to Dr. Summerfield, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that it's entirely biological or overwhelmingly biological, that sounds like a bad joke. I went to my doctor for a cow. I went to my doctor for an antidepressant and she gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the leading medical body in the world, the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not weak, you're not crazy, you're not a machine with broken parts, you're a human being with unmet needs, and what you need is practical help to get those needs met. The leading doctor at the United Nations on mental health said we need to talk less about chemical imbalances and more about power imbalances. I mean, think about it. Half of all Americans, through no fault of their own because of this insane transformation of the economy, have less than $500 in savings for when an emergency comes along. Well, of course they're going to be depressed in that right. situation. And then they go to their doctor and they're told, oh, there's just a problem in your brain. Now, I want to stress there are real biological contributions to depression and anxiety. Drugs can give some relief, but we've told this ludicrously simplistic story. The factors that cause depression and anxiety, for which there is enormous scientific evidence, have objectively gone up in many cases. And lo and behold, more people have in fact become depressed and anxious. And yet what we've done is we've told people a reductively biological story about that. And it's cut us off from hearing the signal, right? This depression, this anxiety, this addiction crisis, they are signals. They are telling us something. We've got to stop insulting the signal by saying it's a sign of weakness or craziness and start listening to that signal.
Early in the book, you write about the in the 70s where they had the checklist for reasons for depression. And I think one of them was like mourning. Talk about that dynamic, how they sort of, you know, if someone you knew died, they were like, oh, well, that's not actually, you're not. You don't have depression because you should be upset about that. But
So this tells you something really profound about how we misunderstand pain in this culture. So in the 1970s, the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, decided they were going to standardize how they diagnosed depression and anxiety across the country, which is a good idea. So they drew up, it's kind of simple, they just drew up a checklist of 10 symptoms, kind of obvious things like crying all the time, feeling life is not worth living. And they send them out to doctors all over the US and they say, if your patients show more than 5 of these 10 symptoms for more than 2 weeks, diagnose them as mentally ill, do what you can. So doctors start using this. But after a while, they come back and they go, look, we've got a bit of a problem here. If we use this guideline, we're going to have to diagnose every grieving person as mentally ill because this is how you feel when someone you love dies. And the APA were like, shit, that's not what we meant. So they added something that became known as the grief loophole. They said, okay, if anyone shows more than 5 of these 10 symptoms for more than 2 weeks, they're mentally ill, unless someone they love in their family has died in the last year, in which case they're not mentally ill. It's totally normal to feel like that. Don't pathologize them. But of course, that begs the question, well, hang on a minute. So this is a brain disease. This is just a problem in your brain that can just be identified on a checklist unless someone you love has died. Why is that the only situation where you're allowed to feel like this without being told you're mentally ill? Why not if you've lost your job? Why not if you've lost your home? Why not if you're stuck in a job you hate for 40 years? Everyone can fill in a load of scenarios. But that was such an inconvenient, as Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, who's one of the leading experts on this, put it to me, that requires you to look at context. We don't have a mental health system that is designed to look at context. We're designed to just identify things on a checklist. This was such an inconvenient conversation that the APA just got rid of the grief loophole. So now, if your child dies at 10 a.m. and you're still showing all the symptoms of grief at 10:30 a.m., you can be diagnosed as mentally ill. In fact, nearly 10% of all grieving parents are diagnosed and drugged in the first 48 hours after their child dies. And as Dr. Cacciatore put it to me, this shows we just don't understand pain, right? Grief is not a mental illness. We grieve because we have loved. This is a necessary human response. And I think it tells us something really interesting and important, that grief and depression have the same symptoms. I think part of what depression is grief for your own life not going how it should. It's grief for your own needs not being met. Now, if you are you know, when someone we love dies, we can't fix that, right? We can hold the people who survive. We can honor the memory of the person who's died, but we can't bring back the dead. But when we're grieving for our own lives, we can together, not in this individualistic neoliberal way, but together as citizens, we can change these factors, right? You mentioned our mutual friend, Rutger Bregman, who's a wonderful person who I interviewed for my book, Lost Connections, because he's talked a lot about one of these key antidepressants, right? So we talked about the incredible financial insecurity that has spread across this culture, right? As wealth has been sucked up to the top, right? As Bernie says, the top three richest people in this country have more money than the bottom half of the country, right? The whatever it is, the six heirs of the Walmart fortune who did nothing to earn their money, their heirs have more than the bottom 100 million Americans. So in Canada, they did an experiment with what we can do about that. In the early 1970s, the Canadian government chose, genuinely at random, a town in Manitoba called Dauphin. And they said to a huge number of people in that town, okay, guys, from now on, we're going to give you a guaranteed minimum income. There is nothing you have to do in return for it. And there's nothing you can do apart from going to prison that means that we'll take it away from you. We just want you to have a good, secure life. It was the equivalent, converted into US dollars and converted into today's money, of $12,000 a year. So not so much that you're going to live well, but you know, you're not going to be homeless if you've got $12,000 a year. And this was monitored to see what happened. A wonderful person who I interviewed called Dr. Evelyn Forget did the best research on this. Loads of things happened, but to me, the most important is there was a really big fall in mental health problems across the board. Mental health problems that were so severe, people had to be shut away in psychiatric hospitals. That alone fell by 9% in 3 years, right? Now, in some ways, this is an insight that's a kind of no shit Sherlock insight. Being financially insecure makes you feel terrible, and dealing with that financial insecurity makes you feel better. As Dr. Forget puts it to me, a universal basic income is an antidepressant, right? But this requires us to expand our concept both of what causes depression and of what an antidepressant is. My argument in Lost Connections is anything that reduces depression should be regarded as an antidepressant, right?
And to some degree, right, there is an incentive by forces in society, and I'm not saying that it's a plot, but there is incentives to, you know, if you've got a hammer, then everything's a nail. And if you're paid to have a hammer, then everything's even, you know, you're further incentivized,
right,
to see nails. And so there's, you know, our society is structured in such a way where the incentive is to pathologize these things rather than to in any way say these are things that we as a society can change.
I think you put that brilliantly, Sam, because what we've done is we have depoliticized the pain caused by things like neoliberalism, right? So there were changes in the society that totally understandably and predictably made a lot of people feel a lot worse. And I want to stress that are real biological components, but by telling a story that is primarily or entirely biological, what we did is we depoliticized that pain. We depoliticized that signal. We actually cut people off from understanding, in many cases, why this was happening to them and why they felt so bad, and from fighting for the bigger solutions, right, for the better solutions. A lot of those people who have been given drugs, which have indeed taken off some of the edge of their pain, but we know from the long-term research into chemical antidepressants, for most people don't solve it. And a lot of those people, what did they need? They needed a democratic workplace. They needed a universal basic income. They needed a ban on advertising that's designed every day to make us feel like shit. There's a whole range of factors. I also talk about more individual things that people can do. But if we don't understand what the signal is, we can't respond to the signal in a meaningful way. If you don't have an accurate map, you can't find your way through the territory. And what I'm trying to do in Lost Connections, my book Lost Connections, is redraw the map in line with the best scientific evidence. And this is one of the things that was really surprising to me. This isn't some kooky, you know, fringe left-wing position. This is the position of the leading medical bodies in the world, the World Health Organization, the leading doctors at the United Nations. This isn't some This has been well known for a long time. It's just not translated into how we've had our depression and anxiety explained to us. And so it's one of the reasons why we're in this disaster. We haven't been told the right story, and therefore we can't find the right solutions.
Okay, and I appreciate your hanging with me. I know I've held you for quite a while, but I just wanted before we because
I've got as much time as you need. Yeah,
all right. Well, and obviously, folks will pick up the book, but I want to talk about the disconnection from childhood trauma, just because that is one of those things that is ostensibly right outside of both the a biological imperative to suffer depression, and also outside of the way that society is structured, theoretically.
Yeah. So I find this one quite hard to talk about. The best way to explain it is to tell you a story. And if I tell you the story for a minute, you're going to think, why is he telling me this? This has nothing to do with depression, but I don't think people can understand it. They don't understand the story. It'll take about 3 minutes. Have you got time?
Go.
Great. So, in the 1980s, in the mid-1980s in San Diego, a doctor called Vincent Felitti was approached by Kaiser Permanente, the big not-for-profit medical provider there, and given a quite difficult task. They said to Dr. Felitti, we've got this big problem. Obesity keeps going up and up every year, and nothing we're doing is dealing with it, right? We give people nutritional advice, it doesn't help. Even if we give them personal trainers, it doesn't make much difference. What can we do? So they gave him a quite big budget, and they said, just do blue skies research, go away, figure out what the hell we can do. So Dr. Felitti starts to work with 250 severely obese people, people who weighed more than 400 pounds, and people who've tried everything, and they're really at risk of dying. And he starts to work with them, he's interviewing them, and one day he has an idea that seems, and in some ways is, quite stupid. He asked himself, what would happen if really obese people literally stopped eating? And we gave them like nutritional supplements, like we vitamin C shots so they didn't get scurvy, stuff like that. Would they actually burn through the fat stores in their body and lose weight? So obviously with a shit ton of medical supervision, he starts to do that. And in one sense, initially, it worked. There's a woman who I'm going to call Susan to protect her medical confidentiality, who went down from being more than 400 pounds to 138 pounds, an incredible transformation, not untypical of the group. And her family is celebrating, she's celebrating, they're telling Dr. Felitti he saved her life. And then one day something happened that no one expected. Susan cracked, she went to KFC or whatever it was, she starts obsessively eating. And pretty soon she's back, not quite where she was, but at a dangerous weight. And Dr. Felitti calls her in and he's like, Susan, what happened? She looked down. She was really ashamed. She said, I don't know. I don't know. And that was when Dr. Felitti started asking her some other questions that never occurred to him to ask. He said, it actually started by saying, well, tell me about the day you cracked. Did anything happen that day that didn't happen any other day? It turned out something had happened that day that had never happened to Susan. She'd been in a bar and a man had hit on her. Not in a horrible way, not in a predatory way, quite a nice way. But she'd felt really frightened and she just wanted to eat. That was when Dr. Felitti asked her, well, when did you start to put on your weight? In her case, it was when she was 11. He said, well, did anything happen when you were 11 that didn't happen when you were 9, didn't happen when you were 14, anything that year? And Susan looked down again and she said, yeah, that's when my grandfather started to rape me. Dr. Felitti interviewed everyone in the program. He discovered that 55% of them had put on their extreme weight in the aftermath of being sexually abused, which is such a higher proportion of the general population and seems so odd. He couldn't understand what was going on. Susan explained it to him really well. She said, overweight is overlooked, and that's what I need to be. He realized this thing that seems so irrational and is really bad for you, obesity, was performing a positive function. It was protecting them from sexual attention, which is something they needed and had very good reason to need. But this is a pretty small group. It's 250 people. It's hard to make big scientific conclusions based on that. So Dr. Felitti went to the Center for Disease Control and got a huge budget. Everyone who came for medical treatment to Kaiser Permanente in San Diego, didn't matter what for, headaches, schizophrenia, broken leg, anything, for a whole year, got given a questionnaire. The first part said, did any of these 10 bad things happen to you when you were a kid? Things like severe neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse. And the second part asked, have you had any of these problems as an adult? Things like obesity, and then they added a load of other stuff at the last minute, depression, suicide attempts, addiction. When the figures were added up by the CDC, I interviewed some of the people, they were just like, there's some mistake here. For every category of childhood trauma you experienced, you were 2 to 4 times more likely to develop depression, anxiety, addiction. But when you got into the multiple categories, it just blew up. If you had 6 categories of childhood trauma, you were 3,100% more likely to have attempted suicide and 4,600% more likely to be an injecting drug user. I mean, these are just crazy figures. One of the scientists who worked on it, Dr. Robert Ander, said to me, it made him realize when you come across someone who's doing something that seems irrational, obesity, addiction, depression, we've got to stop asking what's wrong with you and start asking what happened to you. But the reason I talked about this being one of the really hard ones for me, if you met Dr. Felitti, you would really like him. He's a lovely, kind, good man. And I remember the first time I went to see him in San Diego, leaving the interview and shaking with anger. And walking on the beach in San Diego and thinking, why am I so angry with this really kind old man who's done all this good work? And it helped me to understand why for so many years I had remained stuck in this simplistically biological, why I've been attracted to this simplistically overly biological story about my own depression. When I was a child, I had experienced some very extreme things over a long period of time from an adult in my life. I didn't want to think about this. I didn't want to give this individual any power over me as an adult. I just didn't want to think about it at all. But one of the reasons I'm glad that I stayed with this is because of what Dr. Felitti discovered next. So if you had indicated on your form that you had experienced some form of childhood trauma, your doctor was told, next time the patient comes in, don't call them back, but next time the patient comes in, say to them something like this. I see that when you were a child, you were sexually abused or whatever the nature of the abuse was. I'm really sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened. Would you like to talk about it? And 40% of patients didn't want to talk about it. 60% did. And they wanted to talk about it on average for 5 minutes. It was then randomized. Some of them were told, we can refer you to a therapist to talk about this more. What's incredible is just those 5 minutes of an authority figure saying, I'm so sorry, this should never have happened to you. That alone led to a really significant fall in depression and anxiety. And the people who referred to a therapist had an even bigger fall. And this fits with a wider body of evidence from people like Professor Steve Cole, UCLA, Professor James Pennebaker at Florida State University, which shows it's not the trauma that destroys you. It's the shame about the trauma. For safe places to release that sense of shame and trauma is an antidepressant. But I think you can see in that story, for example, why what we've been doing, often with good intentions, of course, there's issues about big pharma trying to maximize profit and all sorts of other things going on. But, you know, most of the people who promoted this simplistically biological model, rather than acknowledging that biology is real and a contributor, but one of many factors, people who pointed that are mostly well-meaning, but you can see how harmful it is. Right. 13 years, I was given very powerful drugs, right? I was told that this was just a problem in my brain, and nobody ever asked me, is there any reason you might feel this way? And don't get me wrong, I don't want to be simplistic about this. I'm not sure I would have been able to talk about those things then. I might have said no. But the fact that you tell people a story that focuses on a real but only one small part of this problem, you cut people off from understanding the deeper texture. And most importantly, one of the reasons I'm not depressed now is because I could release that shame, because I could learn that story. I could understand how that was playing out in my life. Now, I couldn't have done that if I hadn't been exposed to wonderful people who taught me that depression has wider cause and anxiety and addiction have wider causes than just the biology. And this is a shift we have to make as a culture, because we've got to be honest, we've had 40 years of telling people just a biological story and doing nothing but drugging them while the society goes to shit. And where are we? right? Every year the problem has got worse. It's not got worse because of the drugs. The drugs have taken the edge off for some people. But something wrong with that story, with that picture. What's missing from that story and that picture is most of what is causing this crisis in the first place.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Johan Hari, the book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. We'll, of course, put a link to that at majorityreportradio.com. It's fascinating stuff, Johan, and I really appreciate your sharing it with us today.
I love your show. I love what you do all the time, Sam, and I'm really grateful to you for having me on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Johan. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The book is Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. Fascinating stuff. And he's also just, incidentally, a great writer. So very accessible read.
Really positive guy.
Yes. Like a shockingly positive guy.
Yeah, we could all use a little bit of that around here.
He is one of the few people I know who actually use like hooray in a like in his like and is actually it sounds like it's not like it's just like another word that he uses. All right, folks, we've got to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, this program relies on you for its daily operating budget. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we say thank you by giving you extra content every day. Just about every day. I mean, every day. Not every work day. 5 days a week. Let's put it that way. So for pennies a day, you can support this program. And you can always, as always, you can listen to the fun half first if you want. Just jump in. Usually it's around this time. We went a little long in the free half today. And you also get the full show commercial free if you become a member. And we don't have commercials every day, but we certainly endeavor to. But you don't have to listen to them. Although sometimes if you want to, you can also go to the website and read the description in the podcast, get a sense of what the deals are, because we don't. I won't advertise anything that I don't use. Let's put it that way. I mean, there are a couple of things. Like I don't use some of the business software. I have to, but I don't claim to in that instance. But you can get a break. Or Michael's downloaded that free grow your business thing. I think like
hell
enough
yeah,
for
dude.
The entire audience at this.
And by
point.
The way, I think the results speak for themselves.
Jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Talk about a co-op. That's what Just Coffee is. And the thing about Just Coffee is the way they treat the farms that they buy from. Like, it not only, I mean, I don't know what it does for the folks who work at Just Coffee to be working in a co-op. In Madison, they all seem, you know, the folks I've met there have seemed to be incredibly nice and pretty happy. But it provides a tremendous amount of financial security for these farms because they will not bail on them when they run into trouble. In fact, they hang around, I think, far more. I don't even think far is an understatement than other sort of roasters will for the farms that supply them coffee. So check it out, justcoffee.coop. And it's also great coffee. Free shipping, 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. Go there now. Today is Tuesday, folks. So you know what that means.
Woohoo!
No, hooray.
Hooray.
Hooray. It doesn't sound like that.
It doesn't work.
That's
British. There is an accent element to it.
That's true.
I want to just say first, we're getting to be almost a month away from our LA live show, TMBS, with Anna Kasparian, Nando Vila, Big Waz, Wazni Lambre, and tickets are going steadily. And I would buy, if the same dynamic works out as it did with the Bell House, we'll be sold out within the last week because there are fewer seats at this venue. So get your tickets quickly. Tonight in studio, Daniel Bessner and Harvey J.K. join us. We're talking about everything from the global history of imperialism and how that correlates with combating fascism today, the suppression of our left-wing history, and more. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada, we have another episode of History is a Weapon with Sean and Matt Chrisman from Chapo Trap House. It actually kind of is relevant to a lot of what we were talking about just now, or what you were talking about in the interview. Just the ways in which capitalism has fed into antisocial behavior and nationalism on the part of some individuals. Just like they really go into the history of France, because France was first in a lot of these things, good things and bad things, and show how, you know, when you dissolve these community bonds and these feudal webs of obligation and don't replace them with anything, you get an atomized society of messed up people, some of whom believe some messed up things.
A literary hangover. We're talking about King Philip's War this week. There's some stuff on the YouTube channel as well, which you subscribe to if you haven't already.
All right, folks. Quick break. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.